Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along to the Sydney Institute tonight, where Andrew Tink makes a welcome return. He's been here on a few occasions. He's the author of a number of important books, including Lord Sydney, The Life and Times of Tommy Townsend, Air Disaster Canberra, about the air crash in Canberra at the beginning of the Second World War, Australia 1901 to 2001, and a biography on William Charles Wentworth. And Andrew Tink, of course, is a former Shadow Attorney General and Shadow Leader of the House in New South Wales, and before that he was a barrister, and he's currently Adjunct Professor at Monash University. And he's here on the occasion of the publication of Honeysuckle Creek, the story of Tom Reed, A Little Dish, and Neil Armstrong's First Step, which is the topic for tonight's talk. Andrew Tink, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much, Jared, and thank you to you and Anne for inviting me back. It's always a great pleasure and an honour, actually, to be invited to speak to the Sydney Institute. I first saw the film The Dish in about the year 2000, and I remember sitting there watching the opening scenes and watching Sam Neill, who was playing somebody called the Dishmaster, the fictional character Cliff Buxton, walking down a long tree-lined laneway towards the Parkes radio telescope. And I remember sitting there thinking to myself, wrong place, wrong person. Now that takes me back a little bit further. It takes me back to the ANU Law School in Canberra in 1972, when I started dating a fellow ANU law student called Marg Reed. And Marg and I dated for about 3 years, and I got to know her family very, very well, including her dad, Tom Reed. Now, Tom was, pardon if there are any other Glaswegians in the room, but he was a snippy Glaswegian. A very nice fellow, but very self-effacing, yet very businesslike. Somebody who, great economy of words, and never ever talked about himself, never. But on one occasion, I did know that at that time he was the director of the Tidbinbilla Deep Space Tracking Station, which still exists out there, just on the other side of the range of hills from Canberra. But at the time of Apollo 11, in July 1969, he was the director of the Honeysuckle Creek Space Tracking Station. Now, Honeysuckle Creek was an Apollo station built especially for the Apollo program. I just knew vaguely about this, not because he'd ever tell me. I tried often enough, but he just wouldn't open up to me, change the subject to soccer or rugby or something like that. But I did know a little bit about this because there was a NASA Certificate of Appreciation, which was sort of hidden in a corner of the Reed family's living room. And it was clear from this certificate that he played an absolutely pivotal role in the first moon landing. So this is what made me a little bit perturbed when I saw The Dish, because you had to listen very carefully, and I had to watch the movie about three times before you heard any reference to Honeysuckle at all, and then it was very, very fleeting. So, you know, the years went by and this thing still continued to rankle me, and I got to about 2016, and I decided, always looking for a good story, and preferably one that really hasn't been written up before, and I thought, okay, I'll try Honeysuckle Creek. Took it to my literary agency, said, how does a lawyer politician know a rocket scientist? I said, well, I dated his elder daughter for 3 years and it ended very badly. And she said, right, I want three chapters of backstory on that. Well, I got my wife's permission, I got Marguerite's permission, I got a mum's permission, and then mercifully the publisher put me out of my misery and said, no, that's not relevant for the main story, stick to the main game, don't talk about yourself, which is pretty good advice actually. So I really got in deep on this subject and found out the real story, I suppose you might say. So, for the Apollo program, there were three space tracking stations built specially. They were spaced equidistantly around the globe. Why? Because the moon during an Apollo mission remains relatively static in space, not moving too much. It's near side facing the Earth, but the Earth spins once on its axis every 24 hours. And this means that to stay in constant communication between mission control and the astronauts on or near the moon, you need three space tracking stations equidistantly placed around the globe. And there were three. One at Honeysuckle, just outside Canberra, in the high country outside Canberra. Second one outside Madrid in Spain. And the third one at Goldstone in California. And they each had what they call a view period of the moon, which lasted about 8 hours before they were sort of spun around the back and swapped the signal to the next station. These tracking stations could both transmit and receive using electromagnetic radio waves. They could transmit over a distance of 250,000 miles, which is what they had to do when they were communicating with people at Tranquility Base. They would send up voice from Houston. They would send up a ranging code to figure out where the astronauts were at any given time, and they'd also be able to send up automatic commands to the spacecraft where necessary. Coming back down the other way was voice, astronauts' voice back to Houston, telemetry, heartbeats of the astronauts, fuel levels in the lunar module, things like that, and the ranging code coming back down. And this actually proved to be quite important because famously, Armstrong kept flying the lunar module. The original landing spot was no good, covered in boulders, and he had to keep flying for a while till he was out of gas. And when they landed, he said to Mission Control, "I've got no idea where we are. I'll leave it to you guys to work it out." And that was done by the tracking stations, up and back, to find out where they actually were. Summarise it this way. Next year, or from December this year, with the 50th anniversary of Apollo 8, you're going to see a whole lot of film about the various Apollo missions leading up to Apollo 11, one after the other. You'll see people at Mission Control, and there's some very famous NASA-type characters at Mission Control, Gene Kranz and a magnificently named guy called Christopher Columbus Kraft. I'm not pulling your leg. He was the big boss. He was the director of flight operations. They would be running around Mission Control, all talking to the astronauts through one guy, a Capcom, who was an astronaut, the only person qualified to or authorised to talk to the astronauts in space. And the other end, of course, you see Armstrong and Aldrin, footage of them at various times talking back to Mission Control. Well, Mission Control and the astronauts would have been deaf, dumb and blind to each other without the space tracking stations. The space tracking stations were the conduit for everything. Parkes was a radio telescope, couldn't transmit a thing. It could receive quite well, but it could not transmit. Okay, so on to the day of the moon landing. It was a busy day at Honeysuckle because the original plan was, what actually happened was the Eagle landed about 6:15 on the 21st of July, 6 a.m. on the 21st of July 1969, and the plan was for the astronauts to have a sleep. And they weren't supposed to come out until about 4:15 in the afternoon Australian time to have a walk on the moon. Well, Armstrong and Aldrin didn't like this idea at all, and they decided to come out early, and they got permission from Mission Control to do that. That meant that the flight plans that everybody was working to, including Honeysuckle, and they were the size of a Sydney telephone directory in those days, they all became obsolescent as soon as that decision was made, and everything had to be recalculated and so on and so on. In the middle of all this, just as they were absorbing the fact that the whole program was thrown out of whack, a Bentley pulls up outside the tracking station operations room, and out steps the Prime Minister, John Gorton, who then proceeds to have an hour-long tour around the station. Now, Tom Reed had been made aware of this the night before, but he kept it secret from the tracking station staff because he didn't want them to get sort of put out by the Prime Minister's presence, which they did anyway. They were all mightily put out, busy calibrating stuff, and suddenly there's John Gorton standing behind them. But Reid thought, well, I can't, you know, say no to this guy, so, you know, he is the Prime Minister, and so he came. And so that was an hour taken up. And then at the end of it, the Prime Minister wanted to go outside and get a photo opportunity in front of the dish, which was duly moved out of its tracking alignment so that those photographs could be taken. But then it became a movable feast. The one sure thing about that day at Honeysuckle was the moon would rise at 11:15 a.m. over Honeysuckle, which it duly did. Now, interestingly, Parkes is on the same longitude as Honeysuckle, which is to say, if you look at a map of Canberra, draw a line up to Parkes, it's pretty well due north. So the moon rose over Canberra at the same time it rose over Parkes. The critical difference was that at Parkes, with a massive dish, it could only be angled down to about 30 degrees above the horizon. The Honeysuckle dish, being a special space tracking dish, could be angled down to 0 degrees. And NASA's rule of thumb was that for each 15 degrees of elevation was an extra hour until moonrise. And so that's why Parkes was not initially in the picture to receive TV signals. TV was a very late development, in one sense, in the Apollo program. The decision to attempt to televise Armstrong taking his first step was only made about 2 weeks before the Saturn V rocket carrying Armstrong, Aldrin and Collins blasted off from Cape Canaveral, or Cape Kennedy, I think it was then. And a debate had raged within NASA for pretty much 10 years about whether or not attempt would be made to televise this moon landing. The people who were in favour of it were saying, well, look, the American taxpayer has paid tens and tens of billions of dollars. The least we can do is give them a live TV show. The people who were anti it said, well, this has got nothing to do with the mission as such. It doesn't affect the astronaut's safety. It's not anything that affects the operations, except possibly in a negative way by adding extra weight to the space capsule, which was very weight sensitive. In the end, Christopher Columbus craft won the debate about 2 weeks before Apollo 11 blasted off. In the meantime, NASA had commissioned the building of a special TV camera just in case the decision was given to go ahead. And a TV camera in those days weighed about 400 pounds. The special TV camera built for the moon landing weighed 6 pounds. It was an absolute marvel. It could withstand variations in temperature, massive variations in temperature you find on the moon, and also massive variations in light and darkness. And it used some top secret technology which was then being used in Vietnam for the Air Force to find its downed pilots in North Vietnam. So this little camera was duly fitted to the lunar module. It was to be activated by a lanyard, so when Armstrong stepped out or crawled out on what they call the porch of the lunar module, he'd pull a lanyard, out would pop the camera, and it would start automatically filming. I mean, it really would have been used if somebody like my friend up the back here was already on the moon filming Armstrong come down. That would have been a page one story, but it didn't happen that way. So the weight within the lunar module was critical. For those of you who've seen First Man, the film that's currently out, you'll know that Armstrong and Aldrin flew the lunar module standing up. There were no seats in the thing. They were tethered by straps so they wouldn't be floating around, but they flew standing up to save weight. It was said the lunar module's external skin was so thin that you could punch a pencil through it without any, a sharp pencil, without any effort at all. So, you know, weight was at a premium. And the only way they could mount this camera in the lunar module acceptably was in an outside-facing tool locker, and the catch was that it had to be mounted upside down. So when it was activated, the camera would be filming upside down. So each of the space tracking stations were fitted with a special switch, which in those days you could buy in a hardware store for about 5 cents, just a little up and down switch, and it was fitted to each of the tracking stations' TV monitors. And a technician had to be aware to flick the switch the right way up. So as Armstrong came out and started down the ladder of the module, the moon had not yet risen over Parkes, and it wouldn't rise sufficiently over the Parkes dish to get a broadcast quality TV signal until about 7 minutes after Armstrong had actually stepped on the moon. And from there on, the TV image did come from Parkes. But in that first few critical minutes, a big dish at Goldstone in California was the main receiver. It was a big 210-foot dish like the Parkes dish. And Honeysuckle was its only backup. Honeysuckle was this much smaller 85-foot dish. Well, and I remember this because I was in the science auditorium at Sydney Grammar. I was 16 years old and we were all dragooned in there to watch the moon landing. I tell you what, it's much better than a Latin lesson. But we were all in there and there were a lot of false starts. It was on, off, and we kept coming and going from our lessons. And then finally it looked like we're getting close. And this was just before 1 p.m, about 12:55 p.m. On the 21st of July. Brian Beery's sitting there. I think we're watching Channel 9, and Brian Beery's sort of sitting there, filling in the time. And then all of a sudden, this screen behind him lights up. And we all, go deathly quiet for a couple of seconds. And it's all upside down and all over the place and indecipherable. And so as 16-year-old boys, we start up again. And it was during that period that the Goldstone feed, the TV feed, was being sent out by Mission Control to all the world. There was a guy at Mission Control in a special room who was watching the TV feeds coming in from Honeysuckle and Goldstone. He could see them both up on a big screen. And it was his decision which TV feed would go to air around the world, to 600 million people, biggest TV audience in history at that time. And he chose the Goldstone dish, because the dish was much bigger, because he was an American, and they wanted the American dish to do it. Well, the guy at Goldstone unfortunately panicked, and he flicked the switch one way, and then he flicked the switch the other way, and then he started to compound his error by changing the contrast and the lightness and the darkness and all the rest of it, and pretty quickly it just became a mess. Armstrong, of course, was oblivious to all this, coming down the ladder. And when he got down onto the pad of the lunar module and was about to take his first step, the guys at Mission Control realised that if this image of him stepping onto the moon was going to be seen live around the world, there was only one option, and that was to go to the Honeysuckle feed. And so about a minute and a half before he stepped onto the surface of the moon, Ed Tarkington, he was called Houston TV, that was his call sign, Ed Tarkington said, all stations, we're switching video to Honeysuckle. And that's how Tom Reed and his team brought to the world the footage of Neil Armstrong stepping onto the moon. But for their efforts, pardon me, there would have been no TV of Armstrong stepping onto the moon. It would have just passed as an indecipherable mess of blocks, the sort of thing that, if you went to a movie, you'd want your money back on. Well, the American public weren't going to get $100 billion back, but anyway, it was an interesting thought. Tom Reed, as I said before, was born in Glasgow, very modest circumstances. He was exceptionally bright, however. At the age of three, he asked his great-grandfather where electricity came from. And this was at a time when there was no electricity anywhere in their street. And he proceeded into the Royal Navy, became a petty officer while he was still a teenager. This is right at the end of World War II. Then got a first-class honours degree in electrical engineering at Glasgow University, and then came out to Australia on a short service commission with the RAN as an electrical lieutenant. And following 5 years there, he went to Woomera. He was headhunted to Woomera, where he ran the telemetry on British intermediate range ballistic missiles. And from there, he was headhunted by NASA to run space tracking out of Woomera. Just after Sputnik went up, the Americans panicked, and all of a sudden it was all hands on deck to in this space race with the Soviet Union. So Tom came up that way and was in the thick of it all the way. He wasn't the first director of Honeysuckle. It was Australian government policy that the Australian tracking stations would be run by Australians, full stop. So at Madrid, there were Americans in all the senior positions, and of course at Goldstein, goes without saying. The first director at Honeysuckle mucked things up. He was bright, he was personable, he was all those things, but he couldn't run a space tracking station. He wasn't a detailed sort of guy. There were pages and pages of sort of folders of loose leaf notes that should have gone into and been updated on flight plans and stuff. He just didn't do it. And these guys were trying, I got a son who's a commercial pilot, and pilots learn how to fly commercial jets using very sophisticated simulators, and then they're retrained and retested every 6 months on simulators. It was the same with the space trackers. They were trained up using simulations, and they had these very sophisticated planes that NASA would fly up and down along the Brindabella Range just behind Canberra there. The Canberra switchboards would light up at night with all sorts of, you know, UFO sightings and things like that. It was actually the NASA plane. And Honeysuckle could not track this plane. So the head of NASA simulation called the Honeysuckle team into the canteen and basically called them a bunch of idiots, whereupon the director got up and complained and said when he was told to go back immediately with his team and do it all again, he said, well, sorry, we've been doing it all week. We're not doing any more tonight. We're too tired. You don't tell NASA that you're too tired. You don't tell NASA that you're not going to do it again. And so he was moved on and Tom Reed was brought in. To me, the really interesting thing about Tom, apart from the fact that his own abilities as an electrical engineer were second to none, was that he understood that you could have a first-class degree in electrical engineering, and in his case he was a very good space tracker, but just because you had terrific academic qualifications did not mean that you could do anything in the tracking business. And so what he did was he moved on a whole lot of engineers, just like a knife through butter, like the place, just cleaned it out. And to NASA's astonishment, he replaced a lot of these engineers with technicians, Navy technicians. And one of the things he learned in the Navy was that if you want really whippy, smart, bright people, who are practical, who are innovative, who are calm in a crisis, you're just as likely to find them amongst technicians in the Navy as you are to find them on any university campus. And that's what he did, basically, and it was a series of technicians who got right something that they couldn't do in Goldstein. Just as an aside, and I'll stop here, but to give you an idea of the dimension of this man, his first wife died tragically at just at the age of 36 from a stroke. And Tom met a lady called Margaret McLaughlin about a year later. It was actually arranged. Margaret famously said when the person trying to match them up told her that, you know, Tom had four children, she said, why would I have an interest in four children? And I'm a lawyer. I don't have anything in common with space trackers. When Tom was told that she was a solicitor, he said, I need a mother for my children, not a lawyer. And anyway, this arranged meeting went ahead without either of them knowing it. They were sort of, you know, told to turn up at a party without knowing what was going to happen, and they turned up. And Margaret later said, well, I don't know what happened, but within about 30 seconds, I knew I was gone. And day later they were engaged, and the day after that they had their first date. Now, why am I telling you this? I'm telling you this because Margaret is actually an extremely accomplished woman in her own right. She'd had long-standing political ambitions in South Australia and had put them on hold. She came to Canberra in 1965 as a lawyer from Adelaide and put her political ambitions on hold to marry Tom. She remained active in the Liberal Party in Canberra. And then when a young senator called John Knight died in 1981, Margaret was mulling over whether or not to stand for pre-selection, and she was undecided, and finally Tom took her aside and said, "Margaret, you're the only person who can do this job. Just get in and stand, because it's really important." And she says that that's the reason why she stood. She won. She was a senator in the ACT from the ACT in the federal parliament, I should say, for 1981 to 2003, I think it was. And she was the first female president of the Australian Senate. So an outstanding career in federal parliament in her own right. And interestingly, Tom would when he accompanied Margaret to functions. People say, "Well, and what do you do, Tom?" And this is why he's still working for NASA. He just say, in his Glaswegian accent, "Oh, I'm just a public servant. You know, I'm just a public servant." And then later on, famously, after he'd retired, he got introduced to Sonia McMahon, and she sort of said, "You know, what do you do?" And he said, "Well, I'm Margaret's chief cook and bottle washer." So this was the man, you see. And so back in the day, when NASA was, in its glory days, there was no alpha male, right, quite like a NASA alpha male. And Tom Reed was right up there with the best of the NASA alpha males. A space tracking station director at their space tracking station was God. And so to me, this support he gave to Margaret demonstrated to me that he's just a much, much more rounded character than that, and really quite a remarkable man to have sort of taken such a prominent role, never said anything about it, and then happy to support his wife in an equally important, arguably more important career. So that's the story of Honeysuckle Creek and Tom Reed.
Many thanks to Andrew Tink. We've got some copies of Honeysuckle Creek, the story of Tom Reed, A Little Dish, and Neil Armstrong's First Step, and we'll be selling them after the event. I'm sure Andrew will be happy to sign them. And so we come to questions and discussion. We'll finish no later than the top of the hour. Just quickly, before I ask my question, Tom Reed died when?
2010.
So he lived to a pretty advanced age, right?
He was about 83.
Okay, now, it's a fascinating story, but as someone who sort of looked at government over the years, so is the behaviour of John Gorton, because it was unusual in those days, as it is now, that a minister, least of all a prime minister, would virtually make a visit to a place with a day's notice, and most of the staff didn't do it, and it must have been very distracting. So how did they handle the Prime Minister there at a crucial time when if people lost focus, errors could have been made? How was that all handled?
Well, Tom was told the night before by the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Supply, which was then the relevant department, that the Prime Minister wanted to visit the station. And Reed just felt he had no option but to say yes. He was dealing with the highest levels of the Australian and American governments. But the way it was handled within the station, Jared, was that he didn't tell anybody. He just did not tell anybody at the station, because he reasoned that if he told people, they'd start talking about it, they'd start whinging about it, they'd get distracted, all that sort of thing. So it wasn't until, in some cases, Gorton was standing right behind them that they realised he was there. And even some of the most mild-mannered trackers who I've spoken to about this used expletives when they saw the Prime Minister there. But they were very well trained and they just got on with it. I should say this, though, in defence of Gorton. Well, Gorton turned up with Ainsley Gatto and a whole bunch of other people, and the first concern Tom had was there was a sound recordist. And he said, OK, the sound recordist is not coming into the operations area. You can cool your heels with Ainsley in the waiting room. The cameraman was allowed to go in, and there is silent film shot by the ABC of Gorton being shown around. They managed it all fine. Gorton, to his credit, did actually have a great interest in what was going on, and a few days later he came back in a private car driven by his wife, Bettina, and the guard on the gate sort of said, "Who are you?" and didn't recognise him. And in the end, there was this sort of debate that went on with the guard at the gate for about 5 minutes, I think, before the penny finally dropped and the Prime Minister was waved through. He had a press conference afterwards, and was the first visit. And, well, what was it like, Prime Minister? He said, "Well, all I saw were a whole bunch of wavy green lines, and I was blinded by science." To establish his credentials, the reporter had previously said to him, his technical credentials, the reporter had previously said to him, because I actually like Gorton very much, had said to him, "Well, Prime Minister, is it true that you flew Hurricanes during the war?" "Yes." "And that they could fly at 350 miles an hour?" And Gorton put on that famous wrinkled smile and said, "Well, I could have flown one at 350 miles an hour for about 30 seconds before the engine blew up." And I just like that. That's great, Gorton.
Now, just to be fair to the late Ainsley Gatto, who was one of our members here, she was with the Prime Minister because she was the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, and you would expect her to be there. That's where she should have been, and that's where she was. So where do we go now? Andrew, you just come back and stay here.
Andrew, tell us a bit more about Honeysuckle Creek. I go down to camp at 5 o'clock. Where exactly is it, and why was it chosen, and when was it begun, built, whatever?
In the early 1960s, NASA was looking for a new area to build a space tracking complex. Woomera had been the main centre, but the problem with Woomera is that it was in the deep desert, and a lot of people would go to Woomera from the UK and so forth to work there, and they decided to turn around and go back to England before the propellers on their planes had stopped spinning when they saw what it was like out the window after they'd landed. So lifestyle and environment were important. Because of this issue of the Earth spinning once on its axis, NASA had figured out, and the way objects orbit the Earth before they go into translunar flight and stuff, NASA figured out they needed a facility in Australia. And that's still the case. That's still the case. The Mars mission today and all the rest of it. I mean, we are deeply involved in that stuff. So the then Prime Minister, Menzies' pet project was Canberra, the national capital, and it ticked all the boxes. There was a light industrial area in Fishwick where when the bits and pieces for a space tracking dish were brought in from the States, they had the capacity to construct that sort of thing there. Second thing was that there was a university there, and the third thing was that the lifestyle was pretty good, and even in those days it was quite a sophisticated little town. So in that sense it ticked all the boxes. So there were three types of space tracking station built. First of all, the deep space tracking stations. That's tracking things in Mars at the moment, and way out beyond the solar system, all over the place, deep space. Second one built was at a rural valley, and that was to track multiple satellites in Earth orbit. That's gone now because it's not needed anymore. They can actually track from space. And the third one was at Honeysuckle, specifically for the Apollo program. Now, they were built with a series of sort of ridges between them, which separated each out from radio waves and so forth interfering, and out the back of Canberra. Honeysuckle Creek is right up in the high country. You go out to Tharwa, and then you follow the road, and you go, 10, 15 miles and make a turn onto a road called Apollo Road, and you go right up to Honeysuckle Creek. It is well worth a drive. It's a sealed road, thanks to NASA. And although the dish is not there anymore, It is one of the most beautiful places in Australia that I know of. It's right up in the high country, and it's just beautiful and easy access and well worth a visit. Aurora Valley's a little bit further on, but they are beautiful places. The Dish still exists. It's now down at Tidbinbilla. It's right opposite the visitor sort of entrance area. It remained in use until 2010, tracking various things down there as an auxiliary dish. And then it sort of wore out a bit, and it's now in a stowed position, and NASA recognises it as an historic landmark, as does finally the CSIRO. In the past 12 months, they've actually gone public and said for the first time on the record, well, it was Honeysuckle that got that footage of Armstrong, not the Parkes dish. Point being that the CSIRO has a huge proprietorial interest in Parkes and the Parkes story. So anyway, that is finally being sorted. And I didn't mean to be disparaging about Ainslie, by the way.
No, it's just some people in the audience laughed.
Thanks, Mr. Tink. You've alluded earlier on to the sort of technology that was going on. That's 50 years ago, and things have moved on incredibly since then. Obviously, NASA had huge regard for the Australians in those days, or we hope so, and you've just said that we are heavily involved still in the Mars project, so NASA still has very high regard, one hopes, for Australians and technology. Could you maybe just expand a little bit on that, please?
It does. There's no question about that. We punched way above our weight at that most critical moment when the first man stepped onto the moon. It's a never-to-be repeated moment. It's the first time in history that a human being has stepped onto a celestial body. It may well happen again, but it'll never be a first again. And without Honeysuckle, there would have been no live footage of that. So, obviously 99.9% of the Apollo program, which was just massive, 400,000 people were involved in it one way and another, is American. We could show in reality and symbolically that we could do the business with the best of them and without an American around. There are Americans embedded at Parkes because Parkes only came on at the last minute. And they did a good job too when the moon rose over Parkes, to be fair. But this was an Australian or Australian residence show, and it was done then, it can be done now. I think the crowd down there at Tidbinbilla do an excellent job, and they're an integral part of the Mars mission and all the rest of it. But, it takes constant effort and constant training, and you've got to really work hard to stay up to the mark. Properly led, Australians can do that.
Question here?
Yes, thanks for a very interesting talk. And what is interesting, of course, is that times were based on Houston times. So in actual fact, they landed on the moon on Sunday the 20th of July, but out here, of course, was the 21st. But the main question is, did our scientists here have to go to the United States to get any further training and things like that, in the science and all that sort of thing?
It's interesting. With Auroral Valley, even though it was actually very important, there was virtually no training in the United States. The trackers at Auroral Valley had to learn it locally. For Honeysuckle and the Apollo program, they were going constantly to the United States, all the time, back and forward, back and forward. Tom would make three or four trips a year. And this is back in the day when it wasn't that common to fly to the United States, and you'd get on a 707 and you'd go via Fiji and Honolulu, and so ended up in, I don't know, New York, I think, and then you'd have to get another plane down below Washington somewhere, and you'd end up at Wallops Island, which is where a lot of the business was done with simulations and stuff, which is right on the East Coast. So huge business getting there, and they'd bring in trackers from around the world, and they try and get them all sorted. It was the first major network, major international communications network, and with a series of landlines, microwave links, undersea cables, all sorts of things. It was all sort of wired up and interconnected. And at his desk, Tom could the operations one console. Tom could talk to Mission Control. He could talk to any other space tracking station. A whole lot of other people besides around the world, and in an emergency, but only in an emergency, they could talk to the astronauts. And that only happened once or twice. I think Apollo 16, there was an earthquake or something on the west coast of the US, and it severed a communication link. And famously, one of the trackers at Honeysuckle spoke to the Apollo 16 guys on the moon or around the moon, and they ended up talking about Western Australian lager or Swan lager. And John Young was, I think, in command of that operation or very senior in it. And later on, he came out to visit. I think it might have still been Honeysuckle Creek then. And John Saxon, who was the controller who spoke to him, John's still alive. John sort of famously presented John Young with a six pack of Swan Lager.
There's a question here.
Andrew, in the movie, there was a suggestion that we lost track of the spacecraft on the way. The guys at the station sort of moved to the dish and pointed it at the moon and re-established contact. Was that true, or was that just there to spice up the movie?
I think that was there to spice up the movie. My sense of it was that the trackers were right on the money, except where Armstrong was, manoeuvring the lunar module, just right above the moon's surface, quite fast and like this, and it just took them a few moments to find him again. But that was not sort of like losing them in space, so to speak. It all went very well. The only time they had real trouble was as the lunar module went into lunar orbit, separated from the command module, and then proceeded to start its descent towards the moon, a critical phase. Honeysuckle wasn't involved in that. It was not in view. Gulston was. But the trackers and mission control only had intermittent communication because, still debated to this day, the angle of the antenna wasn't right, or the interference from the moon's surface against the angle of attack and that sort of thing wasn't right. But they just had a few moments of trouble with that, but it all settled down very quickly. There was one alarm that went off, a 1202 alarm, I think it was, which was basically a computer crashing abort alarm, and the guys at Mission Control were asked for their advice. That's what they were there for. And they said, no, we've had one of these in a simulation. You just punch your way through it. Just ignore it and keep going. And so they did, and they managed to get in and land. But it was the whole thing was a pretty spectacular success. What people don't understand, I think, is how many things could have gone wrong. Like, there are just so many little things that all just one depended on the other that could have gone wrong. And that lesson wasn't learnt till Apollo 13, when all of a sudden everybody went, well, this is not quite as easy as we thought. The other great and terribly tragic learning point was Apollo 1, where the three astronauts were incinerated on the launch pad during a simulation. And of course, mistakes went on later. They had two space shuttle disasters, and the engineering at every stage, especially if you're trying something new, is just quite critical. It's the same with aircraft. You go into a completely new type of aircraft, and you never quite know. I remember the Comet was an example of that.
Yes, the Comet.
Andrew, thank you for your fascinating talk. I'm wondering whether at an academic and scientific and research level, is Australian institutions like ANU getting closer to NASA? Is there a building link there?
I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. I've got an association with the ANU, but I'm not quite sure. Personally, I think it's driven out of the deep space tracking station at Tidbinbilla. There are all sorts of academic scientific efforts going on around NASA and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, separate work being done, but the direct work done by the tracking stations, I think that's held pretty close in by the guys who work there. They're CSIRO people. Ed Cruzens, I think, is the director. And the people who run the stations out of the United States. So it's pretty tight. But my understanding is it's still, Australians and Australian residents who are doing the business. And it's topical, I suppose, because the government's just come out with a policy to set up a space agency, which I think is a wonderful thing. You know, it might revitalise this a bit.
There's a question here.
Thank you, Andrew. I have a close friend, Ivan White, who was in the communications, worked for NASA. He lived in Sydney at the time, and they were talking with, I guess, Telstra people, and they selected him. I didn't know anything about it until I was in his study one day, and I looked across, and there was that little monument thing that they give everybody that worked on NASA, then he told me. So there were, and he didn't go to America, he said. They took expertise from him here.
That's actually a really important point. I mean, I've been banging on about honeysuckle because I've got a vested interest in it. It just makes a nice story. But the local backup here was really important. The Overseas Telecommunications Commission had a role. The Postmaster General's Department, I think it would have been then, had a very active role. The Deakin Exchange, which in Canberra there, the Deakin Exchange was critical in the whole thing. Basically, just all linked up, all networked. Now, they had some scary moments, though. A lot of the cables and stuff that were laid were last minute. And I think more than once, farmers sort of dug through the cables by mistake, ploughed them up and that sort of thing, and they had to be reconnected. There was a lot of technology that wasn't wonderful. NASA, of course, July, it's high summer in Madrid and California and also Houston, but of course it's winter in Australia and can be very bitter winters up at Honeysuckle, and indeed for Apollo 10, which happened just a few weeks before, they got a dish full of snow and they had to break track to dump the snow. And I don't think that NASA really sort of fully understood the tracking conditions. It got so cold up there that you know, you couldn't put your hand on an external metal railing without your gloves on, or you'd lose about two layers of skin. So these created special problems. A lot of the stuff at Honeysuckle, because it was only ever going to be a backup station, a lot of the stuff put up was, you know, in some ways jerry-built. They were doing outside broadcasts by then of things like football games and stuff in Sydney, but the links only ever had to be up in winter for a couple of hours. But these links at Honeysuckle, using the same sort of links, they had to be up for days. And they kept blowing up, so they were sort of liberally coated with epoxy resin and all sorts of other things to sort of try and keep them watertight. And Tom and his crew did all sorts of innovative things like that that NASA just never understood. The NASA guys only ever came out to Australia in summer, you know, surf's up, sun's out. Never, I don't think they ever understood it snowed up there.
Question up there.
Wonderful story. Wonderful story. As a historian, how would you compare Australian-US relations at the time with Australian-US relations now?
In case it get picked up, the question is, how would you compare? Well, I'm not sure this is related to your topic, but how would you compare US-Australia relationships then and now?
I spent a year as an exchange student in the United States in 1970-71. I have a very great number of American friends that I stay close to. I go over every year for high school reunions. And as between ordinary Americans and Australians, I like to think that our relationships are as good as ever. They understand the world like we do. They believe in the things we do, all the rest of it, which in this day and age, I just think is vitally important. And then there's the current president, and I will say no more. But I just do not think, without particularly passing judgment on him, but I just do not think that, you know, he represents that sort of underlying continuity between this country and the United States, which I hope will persist in perpetuity, despite whoever their president might be or our prime minister might be. And sorry, we'll get on the bandwagon here for a second.
But Trump's pretty favourable to Australia, isn't he? I mean,
I hope. My concern, Jared, is that he seems to be inconsistent on a lot of things, and there just needs to be some sort of focus and purpose around particular positions. And I personally, I'm quite disturbed at the moment by China, and I'm quite disturbed by Russia. And I'm just not quite sure that in relation to those two challenges for us, I'm just not quite sure that the president is always on the same page that we are. And yet I know the American people are, because for me, the bottom line with this, to me, it's a question of values. And if you believe in freedom and democracy, however tough that is, and despite some of the results it throws up, if you believe in that, then I just think you have to be really concerned about Russia at the moment, and you've got to be particularly concerned about China. And I personally think that growing connections with India is really important too, and pleased to see the Prime Minister doing that. I've gone off at a bit of a tangent there, but, you know, this is an important point.
Can I get you back on the topic? Okay, I know, now, Derek, just before you do, just leading on from that, you've spoken about NASA's role at Honeysuckle Creek, and as you know, there's huge importance to Australia, to the United States, and the United States to Australia under whatever president is the security arrangements, Pine Gap and that. In those days, half a century ago, was there any connection between the civilian side of what was going on and the military national security side, or were they quite divided between the two?
Well, my understanding is they were quite divided, but we'll never know, because to the extent that there was some crossover, be all subject to the Official Secrets Act and so forth. And there is one story in the book about an incident that happened at Auroral Valley, which is well remembered by a couple of people. Everybody in the operations room was rushed out of the room, and as they were moving out, some guy was moving in with a briefcase chained to his hand. And when he came out and they came back in, there was one particular unnamed satellite which had disappeared from their screens, and all information relating to it had gone too. That incident's in the book. As far as I know, it's the only one, or certainly the only incident that I'm aware of, and the only incident that anybody's ever talked about. But I've got no reason to doubt from the people I know who tell that story that, you know, it's a true story.
I think we've got the final question here.
Russia sent the first man to space, but I don't think they've been to the moon, have they?
Not a manned mission.
Do you want to comment?
Sure. That's an interesting question too. The Russians roared out of the starting blocks in 1957. They had been making a lot of progress with intercontinental ballistic missiles, which is a sort of starting point for a lot of this rocketry. I mean, Woomera was set up thanks to a Nazi guy called Wernher von Braun, who basically designed the first rocket, the first artificial object to go into space. And by the 1950s, this race had developed, firstly to develop intercontinental ballistic missiles, but then the Russians were pretty quickly putting stuff, up into serious space. And very famously, the first object into orbit, which was Sputnik, scared the pants off the Americans. They upped the whole space program, but were still way behind the Russians. While the Americans were, putting a man into a suborbital flight, Alan Shepard, their first guy into space, just up and down, no orbit. The Russians had already put Yuri Gagarin not only into space but into orbit. And they stayed ahead, I would say, until the mid to late 60s. The reason I think why the Americans got to the moon, and I don't think at the end of the day the Russians ever got close, was the Americans... The first original seven astronauts were public figures before they went into space. Why? Because NASA relied on Congress for funding. So the original seven were all profiled in Life magazine. And what NASA realised quickly was they were probably going to lose some of these guys, but they had to be seen by the public to be doing everything reasonable to preserve life, to keep public support going. And that's part of the reason why they had this very sophisticated network of tracking stations to keep track and to watch their vital signs and all this sort of stuff. And I think at the end of the day, the base of the American pyramid, which is sort of the space effort, was a lot wider than the Russian one, a lot more stable, and that's why they got to the moon and the Russians didn't. Right up till, well, probably 6 months before Apollo 11, the Russians were building these massive rockets, and the theory was that they were going to have a crack right at the moon. They weren't going to sort of, do what the Americans did, which was to launch a big rocket, go into Earth orbit, then take off from Earth orbit to the moon, and much smaller thing, and then smaller again. They were going to take a rocket and try and launch it right at the moon. And that was another way of getting there. But in the end, they sort of fell over themselves, and their biggest rockets just blew up. And they were so big, it was said that it was like a nuclear explosion when they blew up, just these massive blasts. But they beyond a certain point, they didn't go anywhere. Not with manned missions, anyway.
Just a final quick comment, going back to Tom Reed. He got recognition when, it's in your book, when President Clinton came out here, and there are not many Australians who would have got that kind of recognition. Just tell us a bit about that event. I think 1996, was it?
Sorry, there were two. That the photo you're referring to in the book, that's a photo of Margaret Reed as Senate President with a pretty snippy-looking Tom in sunglasses standing beside her, and then Howard, and then Clinton, and the whole rest of them.
He's there because
he's the president's
husband.
Partner. Yeah. No, but what happened was in 1989, the highest-ranking official ever to come to an Australian space tracking, that's to say the American Vice President Dan Quayle, came out to Tidbinbilla and you can just imagine the cavalcade. If you know Tidbinbilla, you've been out there, sort of windy country road, and the sort of 40-car convoy that these people used. He came out there, and he made this long speech in praise of Tom before awarding him NASA's Exceptional Public Service Medal. And then Reed's called up to reply, and in typical fashion, he just says, "Well, thank you, Mr. Vice President, for this great honour," and sits down.
Well, at least we can remember his speech. Look, many thanks, Andrew, for what's a topic really that hasn't been covered before at this depth or length. So, as I said, we've got copies of Honeysuckle Creek here tonight, and it's very important that people like Tom Reed and the Australians, and you make the important, so many of them, of the people involved, came out of the military, in particular the Navy, and we can understand what the Australian Defence Force has got some very able people right through its ranks, and they're very practical people, and obviously they were the key to the success. So it was Tom Reed, and you point out, plus the team. So we've always got to remember the team. So congratulations tonight. I'm sure there'll be something else coming out off your pen or your computer, but for tonight, well done, and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.